concludes ARRL Audio News for this week. Our thanks to all contributors to this week's report. ARRL Audio News is produced by the American Radio Relay League, the National Association for Amateur Radio. For more information on amateur radio or the ARRL, visit us on the web at arrl.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter by searching for ARRL. If you have a question or comment about ARRL Audio News, email us at audionews@arrl.org. This program is copyright ARRL, all rights reserved. 73, and thanks for listening.
Hi, this is John Hall. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 Acre.
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Would you like to do a show on WGXC?
Interesting, boring, really, 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 really boring.
It would be about wonderful things. It would be about
chocolate pigs.
She's obsessed with pigs.
Chocolate pigs?
Awesome.
All the way down.
I turned it down. Only dogs can hear.
Burn his...
I turned it down. Do it.
Did you hear that?
No.
On Saturday, December 10th, the Athens Cultural Center puts on the 2022 Athens Victorian Stroll, a holiday tradition that's been gone for a few years because of the pandemic, but is back this year with all sorts of free activities from 1 p.m. in the afternoon through the evening. Take a stroll through the village, sample all sorts of food and drinks. Santa Claus will be around and carolers will be singing. That's at the 2022 Athens Victorian Stroll on Saturday, December 10th. Go to the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org for more information.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXC 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXC needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at wgxc.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you will do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Spike's Record Rack in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
This is WA3QIZ. Do you read me?
Seymour, isn't it about time you made a real friend?
Mother, please, I'm communicating with my fellow hams.
How do I talk? Push this button here. You're all losers!
I'm Tom Rowe in the WGXC newsroom with the WGXC news update. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Melanie Lekasevic is reporting for Capital Region Independent Media that the Code Red emergency alert system is coming to Queemans. The town board in the southern Albany County town first proposed buying the mass notification system in July and announced last week that residents can begin signing up.
Town Supervisor George McHugh was absent from the meeting, so Deputy Town Supervisor Daniel Baker conducted the meeting in his absence. Quote, Code Red is a townwide emergency type management system. You can sign up and get alerts to your cell phone, your landline, or your computer if you choose, unquote, Baker explained. Residents are being directed to sign up for the free service on the town website at queemans.org. Town Clerk Candace McHugh said, quote, for people who don't want to do it that way or maybe aren't computer savvy, give us a call, unquote. The Code Red alert system is being used in the nearby village of Coxsackie and the town of Saugerties. Emergency Manager Bill Bruno, Highway Superintendent Daniel Baker, Town Clerk Candace McHugh, and Town Supervisor George McHugh will administer the system. Quote, we will have the ability to put messages out there, so if there is a highway issue, if there is a tree down and the road is closed, or if there's an automobile accident, a message will come across whatever device you checked, unquote, Baker said. Quote, it's a good way to get emergency messages and public messages out to the residents, unquote. The system will cost the town roughly $4,000 a year, McHugh said in July. There is no cost to residents to sign up. Information is available at 518-756-6006, extension 3. Read more about the story in the upstater.com. Lena Bellamy reports for the Times Union that an Ulster County Supreme Court judge November 18th temporarily blocked Kingston's Rent Guidelines Board's rent reduction measure for the properties covered by the Emergency Tenant Protection Act. The decision by Judge David M. Gandon came about a week after the board voted 6-3 to enact a 15% rent reduction for the 64 buildings, which include about 1,200 rental units in Kingston. It was the first time in the state's history that a rent guidelines board approved a rent reduction. Last month, a newly formed group of landlords called the Hudson Valley Property Owners Association sued the city to prevent it from entering into the Tenant Protection Act. Group claims Kingston was able to adopt rent stabilization because the city improperly conducted a housing vacancy study. The Rent Guidelines Board vote to reduce rents came after months of organizing by tenants and activist groups, including For the Many, Citizens Action, and the Mid-Hudson Valley Chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, as well as the statewide coalition Housing Justice for All. Kingston became the first city north of New York City suburbs to adopt a rent stabilization law earlier this year. The local housing activist group For the Many issued a statement condemning the court's decision. Quote, this reduction was carefully deliberated by the Kingston Rent Guidelines Board after hearing data about Kingston's rising rents as well as testimony from over 70 tenants and their supporters. Tenants described their outrageous rent hikes, some as high as 70%, arbitrary fees, and deteriorating apartment conditions. The vast majority called for a rent reduction. For comparison, only 6 landlords testified in opposition, unquote, according to the group's statement. The matter will be subject of a November 22nd hearing in Ulster County Supreme Court. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Hunter Mountain opened for the season on November 19th. The resort's operations crews have been hard at work for days, and starting at 10 a.m., the slopes were open for advanced-only terrain for skiing and riding off the summit, the resort announced November 18th. Quote, we will not have any beginner-only terrain on Saturday, unquote, Hunter Mountain stated. Quote, our snowmakers have done a fantastic job of getting the mountain in shape for the first runs of the season and will continue to expand the terrain as weather permits, unquote. The slopes stay open until 4 p.m. Hunter Mountain is owned by Colorado-based Vail Resorts, which operates 37 ski resorts in 15 states and 3 countries. Nearby Windham Mountain snowmaking is underway, but no date has been set for opening day. Elsewhere in the region, Rick Carlin reports in the Times Union that Whiteface Gore and Bel Air Resorts, all operated by the Olympic Regional Development Authority, opened this weekend. Bel Air in the Catskills and Gore in the Adirondacks opened on November 18th. Whiteface was set to open November 19th with 2 lifts on the upper mountain operational for 3,430 vertical drop run, the highest in the east. In Vermont, Killington and Okemona were set to open as well. This has been the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom, wgxc.org, for more information about any of these stories.
Lost and damaged, the UN's COP27 Climate Summit. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast, broadcasting today from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. The United Nations Climate Change Conference has convened here in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, It's called COP27, the 27th Conference of Parties to the UN's Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCCC, the ever-evolving, never quite fully negotiated treaty that it is hoped will someday ensure all countries rapidly reduce greenhouse gas emissions to forestall catastrophic climate change. An estimated 30,000 people from around the world have descended on this Red Sea resort on the southern tip of the Sinai Peninsula. The summit is hosted by Egypt, a dictatorship propped up by billions of dollars annually in military aid from the United States. This has been dubbed the Africa COP to highlight the continent's plight as one of the world's poorest regions, already suffering dire impacts of the climate crisis.
This is not an African COP. Africa is not here.
That's Nimo Bassi, renowned Nigerian environmentalist, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour.
The poor people who are suffering floods, droughts, and all kinds of adverse situations, they are not here. They can't afford to get here. They wouldn't get accreditation. They can't afford the accommodation in this city that is mostly for tourists. It's a totally exclusive COP. I mean, the other courts were exclusive, but this is super exclusive. We're all cordoned into a peninsula, cut off from even the country in which we are supposed to be.
Nimo Bassi called the UN climate process itself lost and damaged. While Bassi has been coming to the climate summits for many years, members of the growing youth climate movement joined more recently, like Vanessa Nakate. She founded the first climate strike in Uganda. Fridays for Future grew out of a solo protest by teenager Greta Thunberg in front of the Swedish parliament in August 2018 and blossomed into a global movement involving more than 14 million young people. Students take a school day off to strike, typically on Friday, demanding that the older people in charge take urgent action on the climate emergency. In December 2019, at COP25 in Madrid, Spain, Vanessa Nakate described her early days as a climate striker in Kampala, Uganda.
People found it very weird that I was on the streets, and some of them threw some negative comments like I was wasting my time and the government will not listen to anything that I have to say, but I just kept going.
1 month later, at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, Vanessa was photographed with Greta Thunberg and other youth activists. The Associated Press published an edited version of the photo, cropping Vanessa out of a group of five. The four remaining in the photo were white. The AP apologized and restored the image. Vanessa later wrote in her book, A Bigger Picture, My Fight to Bring a New African Voice to the Climate Crisis, quote, "Being cropped out of that photo changed me. I became bolder and more direct in how I talk about the climate crisis and racism," she said. Here at COP27, Vanessa said on Democracy Now!,
"Apparently we have more than 600 fossil fuel lobbyists at this COP. And yet so many communities and activists from the front lines of the climate crisis weren't able to make it here. There is a quote that I read recently that said, if you're going to discuss about malaria, do not invite the mosquitoes. So for me, it's a worry that we have over 600 fossil fuel lobbies in this place. It's a worry for our future. It's a worry for our planet. It's a worry for the people."
This has been described as Africa's COP here in Northern Africa. Do you see this as Africa's COP?
Well, many people, of course, are calling it an African COP, and it can only live up to that name if the climate crisis is addressed and if what is needed, what the communities from the African continent are demanding for, are fulfilled. And one of those things is the loss and damage finance facility. The climate crisis is pushing so many communities beyond adaptation. You cannot adapt to starvation. You can't adapt to extinction. And that is what is happening right now. Loss and damage is affecting so many communities. So for me, what will make it an African COP is ensuring that there is an establishment of a loss and damage finance facility and also supporting a just transition to renewable energy while addressing the energy poverty on the African continent.
The phrase loss and damage denotes the devastating climate impacts millions are already experiencing in poor frontline nations, those that have contributed the least to global warming. These developing countries are demanding that rich, historically high-polluting countries meet their pledges made at COP21 in Paris in 2015 to contribute $100 billion per year to a fund for mitigation and adaptation. Mitigation refers to investments that lower emissions, like building renewable energy installations, and adaptation to building infrastructure and capacity to deal with the impacts of climate change. For example, building seawalls to cope with rising sea levels. To date, the world's wealthy countries have so far refused to pay for loss and damage, that is, to admit they've massively polluted the atmosphere with carbon dioxide, methane, and other greenhouse gases, in the case of the United States and most of Europe, since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and thus must pay climate reparations for the impacts of their pollution. But those who have been fighting for a just climate transition aren't giving up hope. Hundreds packed into a people's plenary here as COP27 neared its close. Asad Rehman, lead spokesperson for the Climate Justice Coalition, offered his assessment of the entrenched fossil fuel interests as he rallied those gathered for the struggles ahead. The word they fear most, he said, solidarity. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan here in Sharm el-Sheikh at the UN Climate Summit.
New York's major hunting season begins November 19th. In the southern zone, which includes the Catskills, deer and bear hunting seasons continues through December 11th. After that, late bow hunting and muzzle loading season run from December 12th through December 20th and again from December 26th through January 1st. Commissioner Basil Sago said, and I quote, "With most public land across New York State open to multiple forms of recreation, from hiking and nature photography to hunting and trapping, visitors should be cautious, courteous, and responsible when sharing the woods to ensure a safe and enjoyable experience. DEC encourages all visitors to review the safety guidelines for hunting and recreating in the woods before going afield and respectfully sharing the outdoors with others." End quote. While hunters using a firearm must wear hunter orange or pink, the DEC suggests those colors might be good for family dogs, too. See the New York Department of Environmental Conservation website for more information about hunting season in New York.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Renewable Weather Forecast for Sunday, November 20th. We start off each renewable weather forecast with the price of fossil fuels in Greene County. The Gas Buddy website says the Mobil in Cairo has the lowest price at $3.89 a gallon. And then we look at the air quality forecast, which is just down slightly, ever so slightly, from Saturday, from a 29 to a 25 in the good range. The UV index is also down to a 1, so even lower than Saturday. And the National Weather Service in Albany predicts a chance of snow showers on Sunday between 1 and 2 p.m. Otherwise, it'll be sunny with a high of 30 and a west wind 11 to 17 miles per hour with gusts as high as 31 miles per hour spinning local windmills. Sunday night should be clear with a low around 16 and a west wind 5 to 13 miles per hour for those windmills. Monday should be sunny for the solar panels with a high of 39 and a calm wind becoming south 5 to 7 miles per hour in the morning. Monday night should be partly cloudy with a low around 26 and wind gusts as high as 21 miles per hour. Then Tuesday, the prediction is for sunny skies with a high of 42 and a low around 26. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears.
I am Heather Briegel. I'm an enrolled citizen of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin, first-line descendant Stockbridge Muncie, and I work as a public historian and consultant.
Welcome back to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you.
It's been a while since we've had you on this program, and you're now based locally, and as you mentioned, you're working as a freelance historian and consultant. So I'd love to talk about what that work is for you and What are some of the talks that you have been invited to give?
Yeah, I am local now. I'm right here in the Hudson River Valley, which is kind of cool. I think last time I spoke with you, I was still in the Midwest, and I am not there anymore. But so a lot of the work that I do revolves around public history, primarily Indigenous history, and bringing it to the forefront of everyone's mindfulness, making sure that they understand the history of Indigenous peoples. You know, I've been invited to do talks on a number of topics, whether that's, you know, well, this is very timely, but it's November, Thanksgiving. So I've been invited to do talks on how do you decolonize Thanksgiving? You know, who were the original New Yorkers in sense of like who was living in the land? I have been invited to do talks on current and contemporary Indigenous issues, such as the Indian Child Welfare Act, which I did I've done a couple of times. And the last one I did regarding that was at the Brooklyn Law School. And then also on MMIW, which is an epidemic within Indian country that, you know, not a lot of people know about outside the communities. And so we want to bring awareness to that. I've talked on boarding schools and how to create places of inclusivity. So you name it, as long as it deals with Indigenous histories, I've probably talked about it.
What are the talks that you enjoy giving most?
The talks that I enjoy giving the most deal with policy in a historical basis. So whether that is just an overview of federal Indian policy, which I do a talk on, or issues, contemporary issues today that deal with policy, that's what I absolutely love. When I was finished with my graduate school program, I had toyed around with the idea of actually going to law school because I just love policy so much. And the intricacies of federal Indian policy are interesting to delve into and try to understand because it's so different than any other type of law. Well, I did not go to law school, but my love of policy never wavered. And so I really enjoy talking about that, but from historical perspective. So how did a policy come to be? Or, for example, of the Indian Child Welfare Act, how did ICWA become a policy that was needed to protect Indigenous children? So then that leads into other topics that are in Indigenous history that combine my love of history and my love of policy all into one. So I kind of like talking about anything from a historical perspective because I feel like you have to have that historical basis in order to understand a topic.
We could spend a couple of segments just on talking about the policies that have to do with reservations. What are some of the basic things to understand about the history of there is sovereignty over these lands, but it also creates these restrictions and lack of resources. What are some of the basic things we should know about that?
Yeah, I think one of the things that people are completely surprised about when they hear me talk, and when I talk about land or reservations or anything like that, people are primarily surprised to learn that Indigenous tribes, Native Nations, however you want to classify them, don't actually own the reservation land that they're on. It's the deed, the title to that land is held in trust by the federal government. And people are, their minds are just blown when they hear that because you think, oh, you have reservation land. Oh, you must own it. No, we don't own it at all. And makes it very easy for the federal government at any time, you know, to take it away if they wanted to. But this, the idea that the deeds or titles of the land are held in trust by the federal government comes from a time period where the federal government didn't deem Indigenous peoples, Native peoples, as competent enough to handle their own affairs. So if we weren't competent enough to, quote, handle our own affairs, I'm assuming they mean, you know, Eurocentric kind of affairs, then we weren't competent enough to hold the deeds or titles to the land that we were on. So that's just, it's just a really interesting concept. So people are always like, that's just such a concept that people just, they're just mind blown by it. And they're like, so you don't own the land, so, but you live on it. So what happens when you, if you pass away, like, do you get to pass it to your children? No, it reverts back to the tribe. And I mean, sometimes it can be, depending on tribal land policies, sometimes it can be, you know, you can pass it down to a next of kin, but nobody actually owns it. So I think out of anything, that's probably the thing that people, such a misconception about the most, is that we own that land and we don't own it.
Is there linkage between the murdered and missing Indigenous women and the investigations that are taking place where when it, if it takes place on sovereign land, these lands that are reservations, that they aren't investigated properly?
Yeah. So I think you're hinting at, are there issues within jurisdiction?
Thank you.
of who can investigate these crimes. And yeah, absolutely. Well, I don't even know where to start on answering that question, because yes, there are issues within criminal jurisdiction when it comes to investigating crimes of missing and murdered Indigenous women, whether they happen on tribal lands, non-tribal lands. Is your state a public law 280 state? Is it not a public law 280 state? Does the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, have jurisdiction over it? Does the FBI have jurisdiction over it? And what's the role of tribal police? So there is so much that goes into trying to figure out who can investigate a crime before a crime's even investigated. So once that's figured out, which can be quite difficult to figure out, there's, you know, time goes by and leads, you know, leads in criminal investigations become smaller, and perpetrators can get away. And there's also this, it's not a concept, it's an actual thing. Some of it's changing now with, you know, policies that are being passed, like, for example, under the Violence Against Women Act, some things have changed. But if a non-Native perpetrator or person commits a crime on reservation land, Indigenous land, the tribal court system doesn't have jurisdiction over them. And so it gives this idea that tribal lands are just places that you can go to commit these crimes and you can get away with it because the tribal police don't have jurisdiction over you. So you can commit a crime on tribal land, leave tribal land, and by the time the crime gets investigated, you're already long gone. So yes, there is this complicated relationship between tribal criminal justice and federal criminal justice on who can investigate said crimes and bring people to justice for them.
I think it's important here to note that even though it's only recently been gaining some more attention, this epidemic of murder and missing Indigenous women, it's been since colonization, this has been happening, and it's been a long time issue. Yeah. Before I let you go, thank you so much, Heather Briegel, for joining us. What is one thing that you'd really love listeners to understand around the work that you're doing or around some of the issues that you talk about?
First and foremost, Indigenous people are still here. We might not be in the numbers that we once were prior to colonization starting, but we're still here. And we still have histories that are rich and vibrant, and stories that we want to share and issues that we want to talk about. And, you know, you can educate yourself on our histories and be open to learning something new. And so I really just want people, when they see, you know, programs happening by Indigenous artists, speakers, scholars, what have you, go to them, learn, because you're going to learn about a side of history that you didn't know before. And, you know, support Indigenous-led causes, support Indigenous-owned businesses. Like, we're getting ready to do holiday shopping, you know, support those businesses, because when you do that, you're supporting culture and tradition and language continuously happening. And that's, I think, more important than anything in the world.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amanda Lavin and Matthew Devlin are quality assurance workers at the video game developer Blizzard Albany, formerly Vicarious Visions. Their company developed well-known games like Guitar Hero, Call of Duty, and Diablo. They are currently involved in an effort to organize their workplace. I started out by asking them to explain what they do.
I am the audio subject matter expert for Diablo 4, which means I am responsible for communicating with the audio team and understanding what their design is and what their intentions are so that I can create the test cases for it so that we can ensure that their designs are working as intended. We ad hoc test playing the game and trying to execute different actions that a player might do to see what happens and see if things break